for your paperwork. They don't work on Saturdays. Besides, come on. You gotta come outside. He motioned toward the door. The greenhouse that we use is one of many at the University Research Station, nestled up in the valley beside a little creek that flows down to the ocean. Each greenhouse is as big as a gymnasium and is composed of little more than a huge stainless steel scaffolding covered over with sheer shade cloth. The Hawaiian Islands are themselves more or less a string of greenhouses. Plant growth conditions are excellent year-round, complete with daily showers that are more like routine watering events than like storms. I looked where Bill was pointing, up toward the jungled mountains, and saw a bright ribbon of rainbow stretching in a full arc across the sky. Its sharp focus made it all the more brazen and beautiful, and it was bracketed by a second rainbow, wider and fuzzier, a gentle halo supporting the confident blaze of the first.
"Hey, it's a double rainbow,"
I marveled.
"Goddamn right it's a double rainbow,"
Bill said.
"Well, you don't see them often,"
I said, justifying my wonder.
"Nope," Bill agreed. "Nobody sees the second rainbow. But it's always there. It's just that nobody sees it. The big rainbow probably thinks that it's alone."
I looked at him hard.
"Well, you're certainly deep today," I remarked, and then played my part.
"The two rainbows are actually one. A single ray of light moving through bad weather just gives the appearance of two separate things."
Bill paused and then commented briskly, "Well, rainbows are self-centered fuckers who need to get over themselves." I observed that that wasn't likely to happen anytime soon.
We walked around back, got a couple of lawn chairs from the old shed, and went back inside the greenhouse. The far side of the huge space was a shambles, with stacks of dirty flower pots in the corner, one of which had been used as a bucket to hold a big snarl of dirty measuring tape. There was a loose heap of soil in one spot, and we set up our folding chairs next to it, and then sat with our bare feet in the cool, damp dirt. At the other end of the greenhouse was somebody else's ongoing experiment. Perennial in every sense, it had been there before we came, and will probably still be going when I retire.
"How can you not like that?"
I waved an arm toward the rows and rows of profuse orchids.
"Just smell it."
"We've got it pretty damn good, I have to admit," said Bill.
"Never dreamed I'd end up in Hawaii," he continued.
"I worry about Bill. I worry about his past and his would-haves. I worry that he would have a wife and a bunch of kids if he hadn't been hanging around me all these years. Bill keeps explaining to me that because Armenians commonly live for more than 100 years and he's not even 50 yet, he's still too young to start dating. Nevertheless, I worry about his future. I worry that when he does meet someone, she won't be good enough for him. Bill always laughs this off.
Women used to be put off that I lived in a van, he complains. Now they only want me for my money."
Bill is indeed living well. His house rests high on a hill overlooking Honolulu. His homegrown mangoes are the jewel in the crown of his rich and ever-blooming garden. Bill accidentally made a small fortune when he sold the Baltimore house that he had bought as a monstrosity with rotting pipes, shoddy electrical, and a melted foundation, all of which he fixed late at night and without help, turning it into a gorgeous piece of university-adjacent real estate. People still puzzle over the two of us, Bill and me. Are we siblings? Soulmates? Comrades? Novitiates? Accomplices? We eat almost every meal together. Our finances are mixed, and we tell each other everything.
We travel together, work together, finish each other's sentences, and have risked our lives for each other. I'm happily married with a family, and Bill was an obvious precondition to all that. A brother whom I would never give up, part of the package. But people that I meet still seem to want a label for what is between us. Just as with the potatoes, I don't have an answer for that one. I do us because us is what I know how to do. I reached over and picked up a watering can, raining water over the soil covering both our feet. We wiggled our toes and worked the dirt into a nice, luxurious mud. And then we leaned back and just sat for a while. Bill eventually broke the silence with, "So, what should we do now? We're good until 2016, right?" Bill was referring to our funding for the lab. We were indeed financially solid through the summer of 2016, with several federal government contracts in place. After that, however, the lab could still fold. Research funding for environmental science decreases every year. I have tenure, but Bill certainly doesn't. That sort of thing is only for professors. It is maddening to me that the best and hardest working scientist I've ever known has no long-term job security, and that this is mostly my fault. The only thing that I can think to do if I lose funding is to threaten to quit, which would probably just leave both of us out on the street. As research scientists, we will never, ever be secure.
"Hey, snap out of it!"
Bill clapped his hands in front of my face.
"What should we do next? We can do anything we want."
He rubbed his hands together, slapped his thighs, and stood up. Bill was right as usual. Oh, me of little faith. What hard-working team anywhere, doing anything, has any more security than we do? We will be like the lilies of the field, I decided, except that we will toil and spin and sow and reap. I stood up and stepped forward.
"Well, what have we got?"
I glanced around, taking a casual inventory of our scattered equipment. "I know," I said. "Let's put all of our stuff in a big stockpile and stare at it for a while. Something will come to me." Bill nodded at me and walked to the other side of the greenhouse. He brought over the stash of grow lights that were still good and put them down gently beside the wads of extension cords that I had dragged over from the other side. Then we worked together to move the miter saw, as well as several uncut 2x4s and a barrel of particle board scraps. I brought over our toolboxes and positioned them prominently, one with the lid propped open like a deep-sea treasure chest. Bill slid over a few bags of potting soil and set a bag of fertilizer next to each one. I was laying out the different seeds that we had, one package next to the other, when I looked up to find Bill dragging toward me a roll of chicken wire that had probably been rusting in the corner for years. I wrinkled my nose.
"That's not even ours,"
I said with disgust.
"It is now," said Bill.
And then we both knew what was coming. We began to sneak through the orchid experiment, plucking loose hoses and broken clamps, shoving them into the makeshift aprons of our t-shirts, and walking them back to the pile.
"Holy shit,"
exclaimed Bill, as he spied an expensive cordless power drill set down between two orchid plants. Bill and I locked eyes as he picked it up. We have at least 5 cordless drills already, and Bill knows that we could buy any number of them just for the hell of it. We very likely have several times more grant money than whoever owns this tool. Every moral and rational fact argued that we should not have stolen the drill. Except for one. Whoever owned it was not there.
"Well, you know what they say about hell,"
I remarked while adding the drill to our pile. The ambiance is bad, but the company is actually pretty good.
Bill sat back down and cracked open a Pepsi. I circled the pile, tucking orchid flowers into it here and there as if I were decorating a Christmas tree. The drill turned out to be broken. It didn't work then, and we've never been able to fix it. But we still have it in the lab somewhere. Bill and I have never even considered putting it back or throwing it away. I'll never concede that any tool is useless, and I'll never admit that there is one that I don't need. I will never stop being ravenously hungry for science, no matter how well it feeds me. On that day that Bill and I sat together inside the greenhouse, we began to talk about our hopes and goals, about what plants can do, and about what we might be able to make them do. Soon our brainstorming about what to do next included inevitable discussions of what we'd done before. Before long, we were telling each other the stories of this book. I am amazed to realize that these stories now span about 20 years. During that time, we've gotten 3 degrees, worked 6 jobs, lived in 4 countries, and traveled through 16 more. Ended up in the hospital 5 times, owned 8 old cars, driven at least 25,000 miles, put a dog to sleep, and produced roughly 65,000 carbon-stable isotope measurements. This last was our ostensible goal throughout it all. Before we made said measurements, only God and the devil himself knew what the values were, and we suspect that neither one of them much cared. Now anyone with a library card can look these values up, because we published them as 70 separate articles within 40 different journals. We think of this as progress because it is our impossible job to manufacture new information out of whole cloth. Along the way, we also managed to become adults without ceasing to be children. Nothing reminds us of this as well as the stories that we told and retold on that day. At the end of a long silence, Bill surprised me by saying with quiet seriousness, "Put it in a book. Do me that favor someday." Bill knows about my writing. He knows about the pages of poetry stuffed into my car's glove box. He knows about the many Next Story Doc files on my hard drive. He knows how I like to sift through the thesaurus for hours. He knows that nothing feels better to me than finding exactly the right word that stabs cleanly at the heart of what you are trying to say. He knows that I read most books twice or more and write long letters to their authors, and that sometimes I even get an answer. He knows how much I need to write, but he had never given me permission to write about us until that day. I nodded and inwardly vowed to do my best. I'm good at science because I'm not good at listening. I have been told that I am intelligent. And I have been told that I am simple-minded. I have been told that I am trying to do too much, and I have been told that what I have done amounts to very little. I have been told that I can't do what I want to do because I am a woman, and I have been told that I have only been allowed to do what I have done because I am a woman. I have been told that I can have eternal life, and I have been told that I will burn myself out into an early death. I have been admonished for being too feminine, and I have been distrusted for being too masculine. I have been warned that I am far too sensitive, and I have been accused of being heartlessly callous. But I was told all of these things by people who can't understand the present or see the future any better than I can. Such recurrent pronouncements have forced me to accept that because I am a female scientist,
Nobody knows what the hell I am. And it has given me the delicious freedom to make it up as I go along. I don't take advice from my colleagues, and I try not to give it. When I am pressed, I resort to these two sentences. You shouldn't take this job too seriously, except for when you should. I have accepted that I don't know all the things that I ought to know, but I do know the things that I need to know. I don't know how to say I love you, but I do know how to show it. The people who love me know the same. Science is work, nothing more and nothing less. And so we will keep working as another day dawns and this week turns into next week, and then this month becomes next month. I can feel the warmth of the same brilliant sun that shines above the forest and onto the green world, but in my heart I know that I am not a plant. I am more like an ant, driven to find and carry single dead needles, one after the other, all the way across the forest, and then add them one by one to a pile so massive that I can only fully imagine one small corner of it. As a scientist, I am indeed only an ant, insufficient and anonymous, but I am stronger than I look and part of something that is much bigger than I am. Together we are building something that will fill our grandchildren's grandchildren with awe. And while building, we consult daily the crude instructions provided by our grandfather's grandfathers. As a tiny, living part of the scientific collective, I've sat alone countless nights in the dark, burning my metal candle and watching a foreign world with an aching heart. Like anyone else who harbors precious secrets wrought from years of searching, I have longed for someone to tell.
Epilogue. Plants are not like us. They are different in critical and fundamental ways. As I catalog the differences between plants and animals, the horizon stretches out before me faster than I can travel, and forces me to acknowledge that perhaps I was destined to study plants for decades, only in order to more fully appreciate that they are beings we can never truly understand. Only when we begin to grasp this deep otherness can we be sure we are no longer projecting ourselves onto plants. Finally, we can begin to recognize what is actually happening. Our world is falling apart quietly. Human civilization has reduced the plant, a 400-million-year-old life form, into three things: food, medicine, and wood. In our relentless and ever-intensifying obsession with obtaining a higher volume, potency, and variety of these three things, we have devastated plant ecology to an extent that millions of years of natural disaster could not. Roads have grown like a manic fungus, and the endless miles of ditches that bracket these roads serve as hasty graves for perhaps millions of plant species extinguished in the name of progress. Planet Earth is nearly a Dr. Seuss book made real. Every year since 1990, we have created more than 8 billion new stumps. If we continue to fell healthy trees at this rate, less than 600 years from now, every tree on the planet will have been reduced to a stump. My job is about making sure that there will be some evidence that someone cared about this great tragedy that unfolded during our age. In languages across the globe, the adjective green is etymologically rooted in the verb to grow. In free association studies, participants linked the word green to concepts of nature, restfulness, peace, and positivity. Research has shown how a brief glimpse of green significantly improved the creativity, that people brought to bear on simple tasks. Viewed from space, our planet appears less green with each passing year. On my bad days, our global troubles seem only to have increased over my lifetime, and I can't escape my greatest nagging fear. When we are gone, will we leave our heirs stranded in a pile of rubble, just as sick and hungry and war-exhausted as we ever were, bereft even of the homely comfort of the color green? But on my good days, I feel like I can do something about this. Every single year, at least one tree is cut down in your name. Here's my personal request to you. If you own any private land at all, plant one tree on it this year. If you are renting a place with a yard, plant a tree in it and see if your landlord notices. If he does, insist to him that it was always there. Throw in a bit about how exceptional he is for caring enough about the environment to have put it there. If he takes the bait, go plant another one. Baffle some chicken wire at its base and string a cheesy birdhouse around its tiny trunk to make it look permanent. Then move out and hope for the best. There are more than 1,000 successful tree species for you to choose from, and that's just for North America. You will be tempted to choose a fruit tree because they grow quickly and make beautiful flowers, but these species will break under moderate wind, even as adults. Shyster tree planting services will pressure you to buy a Bradford pear or two. Because they establish and flourish in 1 year, you'll be happy with the result long enough for them to cash your check. Unfortunately, these trees are also notoriously weak in the crotch, and will crack in half during the first big storm. You must choose with a clear head and open eyes. You are marrying this tree. Choose a partner, not an ornament. How about an oak? There are more than 200 species, and one is bound to be adapted to your specific corner of the planet. In New England, the pin oak thrives, its leaves tipping to a thorny point in a good-natured impression of its evergreen neighbor, the holly bush. The turkey oak can grow practically submerged within the wetlands of Mississippi, its leaves soft as a newborn skin. The live oak can grow sturdily on the hottest hills of central California, contrasting dark green against the golden grass. For my money, I'll take the bur oak, the slowest growing but the strongest of all. Even its acorns are heavily armored, ready to do battle with the uninviting soil. Speaking of money, you may not even need any. Several state and local agencies have embarked upon tree planting programs, distributing seedlings for free or at a reduced cost. For example, the New York Restoration Project provides trees as part of its goal to help citizens plant and care for 1 million new trees across New York City's 5 boroughs, while the Colorado State Forest Service provides access to its nurseries to any local landowner holding 1 or more acres. Every state university runs 1 or more large operations called extension units, full of experts qualified to give advice and encouragement to citizen gardeners, tree owners, and nature enthusiasts of all types. Call around. These researchers are obligated to provide free consultations to interested civilians regarding your trees, your compost heap, your out-of-control poison ivy. Once your baby tree is in the ground, check it daily, because the first 3 years are critical. Remember that you are your tree's only friend in a hostile world. If you do own the land that it is planted on, create a savings account and put $5 in it every month, so that when your tree gets sick between ages 20 and 30, and it will, you can have a tree doctor over to cure it, instead of just cutting it down. Each time you blow the account on tree surgery, Put your head down and start over, knowing that your tree is doing the same. The first 10 years will be the most dynamic of your tree's life. What kind of overlap will it make with your own? Take your children to the tree every 6 months and cut a horizontal chink into the bark to mark their height. Once your little ones have grown up and moved out and into the world, taking parts of your heart with them, you will have this tree as a living reminder of how they grew, a sympathetic being who has also been deeply marked by their long, rich passage through childhood. While you're at it, would you carve Bill's name into your tree as well? He's told me 100 times over that he'll never read this book because it would be pointless. He says that if he ever gets at all interested in himself, he can damn well sit down and remember the last 20 years without any help from me. I don't have a good comeback for that one, but I'd like to think that the many parts of Bill that I've released to the wind belong somewhere. And over the years, we've learned that the best way to give something a home is to make it part of a tree. My name is carved into a bunch of our lab equipment, so why shouldn't Bill's name be carved into a bunch of trees? At the end of this exercise, you'll have a tree, and it will have you. You can measure it monthly and chart your own growth curve. Every day, you can look at your tree, watch what it does, and try to see the world from its perspective. Stretch your imagination until it hurts. What is your tree trying to do? What does it wish for? What does it care about? Make a guess. Say it out loud. Tell your friend about your tree. Tell your neighbor. Wonder if you are right. Go back the next day and reconsider. Take a photograph. Count the leaves. Guess again. Say it out loud. Write it down. Tell the guy at the coffee shop. Tell your boss. Go back the next day, and the next, and so on. Keep talking about it. Keep sharing its unfolding story. Once people begin to roll their eyes and gently tell you that you're crazy, laugh with gratification. When you're a scientist, it means that you're doing it right. End note. Every book about plants is a story without an ending. For each of the facts that I've shared with you, there are at least 2 baffling mysteries that I'm aching to solve. Can grown trees recognize their own seedlings? Is there plant life on other planets? Did the very first flowers make the dinosaurs sneeze? All of those questions will have to wait for another day. But here I can't resist adding a few more details about how I figured out some of the content and presented it. A good deal of the information about plants in Lab Girl was derived from calculations that I acquired the habit of making during my 20-plus years of teaching in order to help facts stick in the minds of my students. For example, this sentence in Chapter 9 of Part 2. In the United States alone, the total length of the wooden planks used during the last 20 years was more than enough to build a footbridge from the planet Earth to the planet Mars. Was drawn from a simple comparison of lumber consumption statistics, as reported by the U.S. Department of Commerce. 805 billion board feet used between 1995 and 2010. With the average distance from Earth to the planet Mars as reported by NASA, 140 million miles, which equals 739 billion feet. Other places where I have accessed similar facts or statistics for this book include the U.S. Census Bureau, the U.S. Forest Service, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the National Center for Health Statistics, and the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. Making certain of the calculations in Lab Girl was, of course, complicated by the fact that every conceivable attribute one can measure for a particular plant reveals a vast variation when compared to other plants of different species. To illustrate, in order to make the calculation presented in Chapter 3 of Part 1 about the relative abundance of growing plants versus waiting seeds, I pictured myself in a deciduous forest, and so estimated 500 seeds lying dormant in the soil beneath each of my footsteps. Had I instead chosen to picture myself walking through a grassland, I would have estimated more than 5,000 seeds beneath each footstep, due to the fact that grass seeds are much, much smaller than those dispersed by trees, a big difference. So while writing Lab Girl, I held myself to the following policy. Whenever presented with such a choice, I picked the scenario where the scope of variation yielded a more modest result. Therefore, I would ask a reader to bear in mind that each of my claims about plants, impressive and marvelous as some of them may appear, were set up to err on the side of understatement. My calculations regarding a modest, unremarkable tree, described in Chapter 5 of Part 2, were based upon a real tree, familiar and dear to my heart. A small candle nut, Alarides molicanus, very similar in appearance and function to the more common maple. The little candle nut is one of the trees growing in the courtyard outside my laboratory at the University of Hawaii. For many years, I taught a class called Terrestrial Geobiology, and at the end of each lecture, the students and I would go outside to visit the tree and reflect upon it as an illustration of the day's material. As one of the homework exercises for the course, the students and I measured the various properties, total height, leaf density, carbon content, etc., that allowed us to calculate how much water, sugar, and nutrients the tree requires every growing season. That is, the information that I've presented in Chapter 5. In my description of federal funding in the United States for curiosity-driven research found within Chapter 5 of Part 2, I used data from fiscal year 2013 because it seemed to best reflect the most recent and complete data sets across multiple government agencies. However, it matters little which year I used for my analysis, as the total federal allocation to the National Science Foundation has not meaningfully increased for more than a decade. Similarly, my statement that the amount of the U.S. annual budget that goes to non-defense-related research has been frozen is based on data compiled by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which revealed that for every year since 1983, total spending on scientific research has comprised a flat 3% of the total United States federal budget. In studying plants, I am fortunate to work within a field populated by exceptionally creative and prolific researchers, and I relish the time that I spend reading about studies performed by my peers. I worked the story of my top three such studies into the pages of Lab Girl, and I want to credit the scientists behind the original experiments. The Sitka willow experiments were first published by D.F. Rhodes in 1983. It was not until 2004, more than 20 years later, that G. Aramura and co-authors showed how VOC production in one plant could affect gene expression within a separate plant upon exposure, and thus demonstrated the mechanism by which the willow trees communicated with one another. The phenomenon that scientists call hydraulic lift, or water moving up from the strong and out toward the weak, as I describe it, was first shown by Dawson in 1993 within sugar maple, Acer saccum. It was Kavalin and Janssen, 2008, who demonstrated that Picea abies remembered their cold seed hoods. As I put it, by comparing juvenile trees that had been cultured as embryos under different temperatures and then grown for years within the same greenhouse. And finally, for readers who find themselves wanting to know more about the living green that surrounds us, I recommend that they waste no time getting a hold of P.A. Thomas's book, Trees, Their Natural History. A clearly written introductory textbook full of fascinating information. Whenever people tell me that they are interested in learning more about deforestation or about global change in general, I point them toward the Illuminating Vital Signs series, which is the annual publication of the World Watch Institute, a non-governmental organization and independent research institute founded in 1974 that analyzes the ongoing changes, trends, and global patterns found in the data collected each year by multiple agencies within the U.S. Energy Information Administration, the International Energy Agency, the World Health Organization, the World Bank, the United Nations Development Program, as well as the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, and many other agencies. Acknowledgements. Writing Lab Girl has been the most joyful work of my life, and I am grateful to those who helped and supported me. I thank everyone at Knopf, especially my editor, Robin Desser. This is a better book, and I am a better writer because of the care that she has taken. Tina Bennett has been more than my agent. She taught me the difference between a bunch of stories and a book. My great debt to her is my most precious professional possession. Svetlana Katz was my lifeline for years while I was searching for the style of this narrative. She never doubted, and so I kept the faith. No words can describe the gratitude that a hopeful writer feels for the first known author who reads her work and then encourages her. For me, that person was Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc. I can name no deeper comfort than the friendship of those who knew me as a child. Thank you, Connie Lumen, for being my eyes when I needed you. I am also grateful to Heather Schmidt, Dan Shore, and Andy Elby, who after reading some, always came back and asked to read more. This is Hope Jaron. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Lab Girl. This program was directed by Jessica Kay. Executive producer, Juliana Wilson. Text copyright, 2016, by A. Hope Jaron. Production copyright, 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.